This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 100.7 FM Corvallis and Albany. And now we are heading to our live remote.
And you are listening to a special live on-location broadcast from KBOO Community Radio. We're broadcasting at 90.7 FM. My name is Andrew Geller.
And I am Del Crescenzo, host and producer of Bread and Roses every Friday at 6 p.m.
And we are both sitting inside the First Congregationalist Church located at 1123 Southwest Park Avenue here in downtown Portland. For the first in a series of talks presented by Illihi. Illihi is a nonprofit organization which provides participants with tools for understanding the nature of our home here in the Pacific Northwest and for taking care of it.
The theme of Illihi's 2013 lecture series is Who Owns It? And the series will explore who influences, controls, and owns other key aspects of our lives. What we eat, the information we access, the environment, our finances, and our politicians.
Illihi is an ancient word used by the Chinook people to describe, quote, earth, ground, land, country, place, or world, unquote. And unlike the word environment, which implies a separation, Illihi conveys the all-encompassing relationship which ties the people of a place to the land and each other.
Well, tonight the talk is by Raj Patel, and the title of it is Who Owns Our Food? Raj Patel is an award-winning author, activist, and food policy expert. He's made the global food system his passion. After working for the World Bank and World Trade Organization, Patel became a harsh critic of their methods and protested against them around the world. His thoughts on food, hunger, and globalization have appeared in a number of U.S. and international news sources, including the LA Times, New York Times, and The Guardian. He is a British-born American academic, journalist, activist, also a writer. He's lived in Zimbabwe, South Africa, the United States. He is best known for his book, Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System, which was just a new edition, was revised in 2012. His most recent book is The Value of Nothing, which was on the New York Times bestseller list during February 2010.
Patel has a BA in philosophy, politics, and economics from Oxford, a master's degree from the London School of Economics, and has a PhD in development sociology from Cornell University. He has been a visiting scholar at Yale and the University of California, Berkeley. As Del mentioned, he has worked at the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, and the United Nations, but is, after working there, has become an outspoken public critic of all of them. He is associated through his work on food with the Via Campesina Landless Peoples Movement, which is the largest non-governmental organization in the world, I believe, with several tens of millions of members. And he's currently a visiting scholar at the Center for African Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, a fellow at Food First, which is also known as the Institute of Food and Development Policy, and a research associate at the School of Development Studies at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa.
Well, as I mentioned, his most recent book, The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy, has been praised as a thought-provoking guide to the way economics work, exploring the recent economic collapse and painting a clear picture of how to achieve a fairer, more sustainable economy and society. The Value of Nothing serves as an apt follow-up to his acclaimed book, Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System, where Patel not only diagnoses the causes behind our worldwide food crisis, but offers sustainable and feasible solutions to deal with it.
And while I haven't seen any indication of exactly what his talk will be about tonight, I believe he will be talking quite focused in a quite focused way about food sovereignty, which is a concept regarding the right of peoples to define their own food systems. There are six key pillars of food sovereignty, which is focusing on food production for people, valuing food providers, localizing food systems, putting control of those systems locally, building the knowledge and skills of the people raising the food, and working with nature. Patel has written repeated reports, other background papers, etc., for Food First on food sovereignty issues. And you can find more information about Food First at foodfirst.org. You can find more information about Ilahi at ilahi.org, and that is spelled ILLAHEE.org. And this is a special on-location broadcast from KBU Community Radio, starting the 2013 Ilahi Lecture Series. We are located downtown in the First Congregationalist Church at 1123 Southwest Park Avenue, and we are anticipating that we will be hearing from Raj Patel fairly shortly. Again, this is the first in the 2013 series. There are monthly talks stretching all the way through the early part of May, and it looks as though we will have the director of Ilahi doing an introduction here in just moments. If you haven't told your friends and family about the talk, you still have a chance to do so. And here is Peter from Ilahi.
I was not doing a sound check, you know. Well, right. Well, welcome. Welcome, everybody, to the 14th season in the Ilahi Lectures. I'm Peter Schoonmaker, president of Ilahi. And I want to thank our board, our sponsors, our volunteers, all of you for coming tonight to this series on Who Owns Us, and I think just as importantly, what we can do about it. I want to thank in particular Portland State University, the Institute for Sustainable Solutions, who's getting involved in significant ways in food and food policy, and welcome students from Portland State University that are here tonight. All right. And Stoll Reeves, and our media sponsors, Willamette Week and KBU Radio. We're being broadcast live right now. There are implications there for the Q&A. So the 2013 Ilahi series looks at a suite of systems, food, environment, media, finance, and government, that are they're no longer just issues or complex problems. They've become commodities, which is part of the problem, and they're increasingly influenced, even owned, by a small and actually smaller subset of society. And ownership and property are, they're powerful. They're powerful in concept, and they're powerful in practice, in part because most of us, myself included, I think, have an incomplete understanding of the cultural sources and the variations of ownership models. And we rarely track as individuals the components of ownership, who benefits, who bears costs, who assumes risks, what responsibilities are or should be associated with ownership. We generally just focus on that first one, you know, what's in it for me? And then we try and minimize the latter three, which is kind of like a tragedy of the commons, but it's more like a common tragedy. So we'll try to sort out some of that over the course of the series. And we'll begin tonight with author, activist, and food policy expert Raj Patel. And then just to kind of foreshadow the rest of the series, in February, we'll look at who's making the environmental policy sausage with Buck Parker, who's the former executive director of Earth Justice, who led the organization during the critical years of the Bush administration. And then in March, we look at current trends with John Stauber, the founder of the Center for Media and Democracy. John has co-authored 6 books on government propaganda and private interests in the PR industry. And then in April, in light of the recent and probably future ongoing banking and finance crisis, we'll have former Wall Street banker and Federal Housing Commissioner Catherine Austin Fitz provide an insider's view of that industry. And we'll talk about future scenarios because, after all, Catherine was here in 2007 and predicted the crash to this audience of the 2008 crash. And I wish I'd followed her advice. Anybody who did, you're in the 1% now. You probably own an island, or at least a houseboat or something, but we didn't. I wish I'd listened. Finally, in May, author and attorney Jeffrey Clements will speak about the recognition of constitutional rights for corporations via Citizens United, and he'll suggest options to reverse this decision as outlined in his book, Corporations Are Not People. A little housekeeping post-lecture. We'll have a Q&A, and I'll provide the usual admonition that please be brief and pithy and direct, and we'll all think highly of you. Or otherwise, we'll, if you're long-winded and self-indulgent, we'll not think highly of you, collectively. We'll have, after our speaker's talk, he'll be in the back signing books, and we'll have a follow-up discussion in lieu of kind of having the church basement thing going on. We'll have a follow-up discussion to be announced, but many of us will be hitting our local establishments tonight, Higgins, Heathman, South Park, Shigezo, Nel Centro, for a beverage or three, so that's my plan anyway. Now, as you go home tonight, think about friends and colleagues who you'd like to invite to hear the good news about who owns you, and accompany you to the lectures, and then drink about it. Because most people find out about the Illahi series through friends. So reach out to your friends via Facebook or Twitter, or if you have enemies, invite them too, because they probably need to hear this stuff. And if you're here just for tonight's talk, consider joining us for the entire series. We'll be happy to apply the cost of your ticket tonight towards a pass for the remaining talks. Plus, you'll learn about additional events and discussions throughout the season. For example, we'll have Pam Dixon, the executive director of the World Privacy Forum. It's not on this schedule. She'll be visiting in April, talking about who owns your digital life. Spoiler alert, not you. And so we hope to see many of you here for the rest of the series. So, to introduce tonight's speaker, a man who around Portland probably needs no introduction, but I'll give him one anyway. Very briefly, Ron Paul, who's been instrumental in setting up the at Merrillhurst University a master's program in food systems and food systems and society, and is currently the mastermind and the director of the James Beard Public Market, coming to you this decade. Right? For sure. Down on the Willamette. So please welcome Ron Paul to introduce our speaker tonight.
Thank you, Peter, for the kind words. It's great to be able to introduce a scholar activist to inaugurate this series about who owns us, and to focus not only on food, but with food as more than a metaphor. Raj Patel is a scholar par excellence, degrees from Oxford, London School of Economics, and Cornell. But the activism quotient is really what sets him apart. And so tonight we're you know, going to be able to not only listen to him and understand the meaning and the metaphor of food in the broader understanding of who owns us, but we're going to be able to have ample time to ask the pithy questions that Peter asked you to limit to 30 seconds or less. But an important part of the evening that for me is something that we should all cherish are the questions that we get to ask ourselves after hearing a speaker like Raj Patel. So Raj, welcome to Portland.
You're listening to a special live broadcast from KBOO Community Radio. This is one in the series of First Congregational Church.
Thank you for being for letting me be the one who gets to be long-winded and self-indulgent. I kind of feel like most of the question of who owns our food system can be done with the aid of a very simple diagram. And because I don't use PowerPoint. PowerPoint, apparently, people who watch PowerPoint, their IQs drop by seven points. So I don't like to use PowerPoint. And particularly since we have wonderful people listening to us on the radio on KBOO. Is KBOO the only radio station named after a kind of marijuana? It is. Thank you, Portland. Berkeley Boo. I mean, who knew? Even in Berkeley, we don't name our radio stations after kinds of marijuana. So that's splendid. What I'm keen to do is to get you to use your imaginations rather than PowerPoint. So imagine, if you will, a diagram. It's a very simple diagram. It's an hourglass. It's wide at the top, narrow at the middle, and wide at the bottom. And at the top, there are hundreds of millions of farmers around the world and farm workers who are toiling in the fields to bring us our food every day. And at the bottom, there are 7 billion people who are trying to eat every day if they can. So you're wide at the top, wide at the bottom. But in the middle, there are just a few corporations that control the truck and barter of food internationally. So in every major market, there are four or five corporations that basically control half the market. It varies. The international grain markets, for example, are controlled by four companies: Archer Daniels Midland, Bunge, Cargill, and Dreyfus. The market in the world's most widely consumed soft drink is controlled by two companies, which the world's most widely consumed soft drink is tea. And the global market in tea is controlled by just two companies, Tata and Unilever. The world's seed supply is controlled by 10 fairly large companies, but plus or minus, it's roughly five companies controlling more than half the global market in these products. And more or less, these are companies that you may have heard of, and you kind of assume that they're consumer products companies or they're grain traders. But there's a new kind of company that controls the food system in town. And I want to tell you a story about how these corporations really do choke the bottleneck of the food system and really are responsible for owning far more of the food supply than initially we'd think. By the way, am I feeding back? Is this okay? Or I need to go further back? Or put the mic up? How's that? Is that better? Excellent. Thank you. I still loud. Never mind. Here's the story. The story begins with a fire. And it begins with a fire in Russia in July 2010. You'll remember that Russia was having a once-in-a-hundred-year drought. I mean, the temperatures were going sky high. And this is a story not only about who controls the food system, but it is about climate change. And so Russia, like a lot of places recently, have been having these once-in-a-hundred-year events, and they've been having them fairly regularly. Which is a sign, I think, that we are moving into climate. And of course, we're in Portland now, so we don't have to be climate change deniers here. Russia's having this incredibly high temperatures, but Russia, like a lot of countries, is going through political transformation. It's going through austerity, the kind of belt tightening that we've been going through here. And Russia, in its wisdom, decided to cut public services, including cutting firefighters. At the same time, it needed to raise money, so it auctioned off large parts of the area surrounding these wheat fields for forestry, and so there was a lot of logging that happened, and the logging was unsustainable. There was a lot of brush left behind, and so these fires burned madly out of control. So already we have a climate event and a political event meshed together. But here's, you know, the fires reach the wheat fields, and the Russian government is seeing that this is very serious, that actually levels of wheat, the crop is so thoroughly destroyed that actually the price of wheat is going to go higher and higher. And round about the beginning of August 2010, the Russian government has a meeting with representatives from a company you've likely never heard of. The company is called Glencore. And Glencore is a financial, well, it's actually a mining company that also does food. And when they also do food, they also do food in massive style. They control 25% of the world barley market, for example. They invest heavily and provide financial services around the trucking of food around the world. And essentially, they own the sort of ports of call, and they provide financial services in order to be able to make grain trading happen. And Glencore advised the Russian government to institute an export ban. In other words, they told Russia, you know, Russia, if you care about your citizens, what you need to do is stop exporting wheat. And that way, your wheat, you know, you will have wheat for your citizens at home. And Russia, whether Russia followed Glencore's advice or whether there were other reasons why Russia did it, Russia ultimately did impose an export ban. In other words, Russia, one of the third largest exporter of wheat, stopped exporting wheat. Glencore knew, some traders at Glencore saw this coming and made quite a lot of money off it. But the trouble was that there were other parts of the world that needed wheat. The price of wheat went up by 15% in 2 days. And that was a problem for a number of countries, in particular Mozambique. Mozambique is a poor country where 60% of people's average daily income is spent on food. When the price of wheat goes up by 15%, that's a problem. And you may ask, well, you know, what's a demand for bread doing in Mozambique? Bread, it's not, you know, it's indigenous to Mozambique. Well, the reason that there's a demand for bread in Mozambique is because there was colonialism. What you have is, this sort of imposed taste for a crop that doesn't grow anywhere near Mozambique being demanded by Mozambicans. And so the price of wheat went up, and Mozambicans couldn't afford it, and they took to the streets. And initially, the government dispersed protesters with rubber bullets, but then, according to the police, according to official Mozambican statements, they ran out of rubber bullets and had to switch to live ammunition. And over a dozen people were killed in bread riots that were caused by this think of this arc again, right? It starts with climate change, but it's compounded by government policy, by austerity. It's made worse by the traders in the middle who may or may not have actively influenced government policy, but certainly some of them profited from it. And the consequences are felt by the world's poorest people. And that international architecture of wide at the top, narrow in the middle, wide at the bottom, helps explain why we live in the kind of world we do, where the kind of power in the food system is concentrated where it is. Because we live in a world where there are a billion, well, actually now 1.5 billion people who are overweight, and nearly a billion people who are malnourished, who don't have enough calories in the day to be able to just make it through the day. And this hourglass helps explain that. Right? Because this hourglass it shows, first of all, the people who are at the top, the farm workers. Those are the people most likely to be going hungry in the world today. People who are starving are people who work in agriculture. And when you have corporations controlling this food system, they operate by some simple rules. They buy cheap and sell dear. Now, when you're buying cheap, when you're buying agricultural commodities cheap, you are pushing the price down, particularly if you're in a position of being able to control that market, if there are a few of you. And there have been plenty of cases, until recently, one of the world's largest antitrust cases involved Archer Daniels Midland and a range of other companies colluding to drive up prices. But when drive up prices themselves, but still be able to corner the market, and when these corporations want to buy cheap, they're buying cheap and they're pushing the prices down for the world's poorest people. In terms of the revenue, right? If you're a farm worker and this corporation is buying from you and they insist that your price go down, then farm worker wages are going to be cut. At the same time, at the other end of the food system, where the 7 billion people are, you are selling food that is profitable. You're selling food that is rich in salt and fat and sugar. You're trying to sell food that's, you know, that's going to give the biggest return to your shareholders. And that's usually food that is bad for us, a food that is going to make us more overweight. And so, whereas in the old days when you had the world that was stuffed and starved, if you were fat, you were usually rich, right? You have this idea of fat cats of bankers with their collars, so that their necks spilling over their collars. Well, these days, absolute hunger and being overweight and obese are actually two points on the same continuum of poverty, where if you are desperately poor and you're unable to afford food, then you will go hungry. But if you are moderately, if you are poor in a rich country, then that's what's going to correlate more to obesity. So if you look in the United States, in Italy, a range of rich countries, the poorer you are, the more likely you are to be overweight because your food choices are very limited. If you're, if you're in the United States and you're working two jobs to try and keep your health care and you're going from one place to another, it's no surprise that often the only place you find a meal, a place to eat your meal is off your lap, right? And in conditions of where you are working poor, the options you have to eat are very limited. You can't access the fresh fruits and vegetables. Those are usually too expensive. There's rarely enough time to cook them properly. Even the FDA, sorry, the USDA admits this. If you go to the USDA website, and you'll find a thrifty diet plan, which the USDA recommends if you are among the 50 million people in America who are food insecure. There's a thrifty diet plan if you're at 80% of the poverty line. And if you follow this thrifty diet plan, even if you buy all your whole grains and you cook them yourself, and you have all the time to do that, you still won't have enough vitamin A and D to be able to make it through, to be able to lead a healthy and productive life. And so, this hourglass does a lot of, helps us explain where the power is and why obesity and hunger are symptoms of a concentrated power, a system of power. But the interesting question is not why are corporations buying cheap and selling dear, right? Corporations are chartered to do this. Corporations are in the business of profit maximizing. They're built to generate profits and to keep costs low and to keep profits high. The interesting question is, why do we have a global system of financial and commodity markets like this at all? Why do we have this hourglass? Where did this hourglass come from? And to answer that, we need a little bit of history, because this hourglass is a new phenomenon, at least a global architecture of international trade is relatively new. It's about 140 years old, is the world's biggest international market, the most complete international market, was completed in wheat by the British. And the British did this in order to have ways of getting food to workers in Liverpool and Manchester and London, cheap food for them. And so they did this through a process of imperialism and colonization. And India is a country that experienced the brunt of this. And I mean, for those of you unfamiliar with the history of British colonialism in India, this is a very short version. India was a feudal country. Now, feudalism, for those of you who don't know, feudalism is a sort of system where you have landlords who own the land and peasants who work on the land. And it's a fairly crappy system, right, if you're a peasant. Because you're working all the time and the landlord will take your surplus and give you just enough to survive. And there's only one silver lining, which is that in a time of drought or if the crops fail or if pests come and if there's some sort of shock to the food system, then it is the landlord's responsibility to feed the peasant. So everything's bad about it except when there's some sort of crisis, the landlord has to feed the peasant. It's called a moral economy. And most feudal societies have something like this. But when the British came to India and they saw feudal landlords giving away free food to the peasants. They said, well, landlords, you don't need to be giving away free food. We have a much better system for you. And the system involves you paying your workers, and then they will use that money to buy whatever they want. They will buy food, they can buy other things, and you will find, landlords, that your productivity will go up because also we, the British, will buy your food from you, and we'll pay you way more than you're getting at the moment, and you will be rich, and the workers will be free, and you won't have any obligations to them, and it'll be terrific. It'll be fantastic. You'll love it. And the landlord said, no thanks, we're fine. And the British said, no, we have guns. And so it was. Well, I mean, obviously, it's an abbreviated history, but you get the idea. A lot of this sort of economic architecture was put in place through violence, through colonialism. And to some extent, of course, the British did not lie. As a result of the introduction of these global markets, India produced more food than it ever had in its history, per person. By the end of the 19th century, India was exporting millions of tons of grain to feed workers in London and Manchester and Liverpool. But the downside, of course, is that for Indian workers, they were unable to afford the food that was right underneath their noses. So in this case, who owns the food supply? Well, it was the British. And the workers in India were dying as they were working to produce one of the greatest harvests ever seen. And there's a statistic that comes from the historian, was found by the historian Mike Davis, that I think puts this into context, that in the 2,000 years before the British came to India, there was a famine once every 120 years. So if you had a time machine and you went back to India and you came across a famine, then you would be unlucky because you'd have to wait another 120 years for that famine to happen again. But when the British came, and after you developed these global markets in food, and after India starts producing more food than ever before, there's a famine once every 4 years with the regularity of an election cycle. And Mike Davis notes that this global phenomenon resulted in 30 million people dying even as more food per person was produced than ever before. And that tragedy is one that's being repeated again, and it's being pushed on the world. This idea of sort of promoting free markets and letting the market reign, that idea is being pushed by a number of organizations at an international policy level, including an organization for which I once worked, the World Bank. And I know a couple of you may have heard, may understand the World Bank and understand what it is. But for those of you who don't know what the World Bank is, I have an analogy that I submit to you. It comes from the Terry Gilliam film Time Bandits. Do people here know Time Bandits? Yeah, of course we're in Portland. Of course you know Time Bandits. But those of you who don't know, Time Bandits is a film about disgruntled employees of God. I mean, the universe was built in 6 days, so it was a rush job. And the universe has holes in it. God had help, but he didn't treat his workers very well. So these disgruntled workers run off with a map of the universe, and they use it to rob people. And in one scene, they rob Napoleon. And they take Napoleon's stuff, and they jump through a hole in the universe, and these time bandits, they jump through a hole in the universe, and they end up in Sherwood Forest, where they are met by Robin Hood, who's played by John Cleese, as a sort of upper-class twit. You know, he's wearing a big, green, pointy hat, and he calls himself Hood. And Hood's very pleased to see all Napoleon's stuff, and he said, well, this is terrific. Well, thank you very much indeed. Yes, the poor will love this. Have you met the poor? They're charming people. Of course, they don't have two pennies to rub together. That's because they're poor. And then there's this sort of ceremony where it's like, well, let's give away this, you know, just give all this stuff back to the poor. And so it's, you know, there's a line of people brought on, and Hood works the line, and he sort of shakes hands with people. Yeah, hello, yes, well done. Here's a, you know, rubies for you. Yes, jolly good, well done. And your gilded mirror for you. Yes, congratulations. How long have you been poor? Jolly good. And then standing next to Hood is this big bloke who takes whatever Hood has given and punches the poor person in the face. And that's how the World Bank works. So It's accurate. I worked at the World Bank. The project I was working on was called "Voices of the Poor." Can anyone hear us? And it was about the World Bank, you know, and how it engages with the poor, and how, you know, it's basically the World Bank's way of saying, yeah, have you met the poor? We had lunch with the poor yesterday. They think we're terrific. But at the same time, the World Bank is a bank, so, you know, obviously it's making these loans, and so there's always this sort of great pomp and circumstance, multi-million dollar loan, go buy yourself something nice. But of course, many of these loans are loans to cover the loans that were already taken out illegitimately, often by countries from the World Bank. So all of that's conveniently set aside, and of course, the loan is taken back because it's a loan, and the punch in the face comes with the kinds of free market dogma, the kind of neoliberal thinking around, particularly around agriculture, that lead to the kinds of outcomes that, you know, we've seen, for example, in Haiti, where before the earthquake, Haiti was still a disaster because at the beginning of the 1980s, Haiti produced the majority of its own rice. But because Haitians wanted to have a left-wing government and a government that invested in healthcare and education and farming, that was just too much for the U.S. to bear. And so we, through Presidents Reagan, Bush, and particularly Clinton, imposed structural adjustment policies on Haiti. So we forced Haitians to open up their economy to the improving winds of free trade and market disciplines. And the trouble is that when it comes to food, there's no such thing as a free market. I mean, Haitians were denied any kind of subsidy. I mean, Haitians living on $2 a day were denied any kind of support for their farming, while we in the United States are subsidizing our rice farmers to the tune in some years of $1 billion a year. So, $2 a day here, $1 billion a year here. What do you think happens? Well, of course, Haitian rice farmers panicked. And initially, there's a lot of environmental degradation as they try to hang on. But then they give up and they move to the cities where there are sweatshops conveniently built for them to be able to make cheap textiles for us in the United States. This kind of economic structural adjustment of removing supports for farmers is also, it's a global phenomenon. You see it in India, for example. India's a very interesting case because if you think of the people who shape the Indian food system, the structural adjustment that happened in India was much more homegrown. The man who is now Prime Minister of India, Manmohan Singh, was finance minister in the late 1980s and early 1990s. And he did a homegrown structural adjustment policy and liberalized the economy. And there are a number of outcomes associated with that. That we had, for some Indians who had a lot of money, the liberalization of the economy worked very well because there was now all this financial capital coming in, all these big corporations with lots of interest in India. And a few people made it very big, to the extent that a few years back, if you look at the Forbes top 10 billionaires list, there were four Indians in that list. And the four of the top, the richest people on earth were from India. And that's a paradox, because India is also the country where there are more people going hungry than the entirety of Africa. We're seeing in India increased rates of farmer suicide as the government takes a step back from its responsibilities to the agricultural sector. Farmers found themselves confronting not government support, but just the local village power brokers, usually a money lender who's also the person who will sell the seeds and the fertilizer, and will lend at rates of interest that double every month. Extortionate rates of interest. And farmers there found themselves in debt and faced the prospect of losing the land that they farmed for generations. And so, rather than face that oblivion of identity, they chose to take their own lives. And that farmer suicide rate is one every 30 minutes in India. But the story of debt and despair is a global story. I mean, India is just a country where this is happening. And if you look again at India, it's also a source of another paradox, which is that India is now, according to some studies, home to the largest population of people living with type 2 diabetes. India, you know, again, home to the largest number of poor people on earth, also home to the largest number of people with type 2 diabetes. In some southern Indian cities, the diabetes rate is 20%. One in five people with type 2 diabetes. And, you know, in part, it has to do with, again, liberalization. Before India liberalized its economy in 1990, you didn't have Coke or Pepsi. You just had Thumbs Up, which is a local variant. I don't know if anyone's tried Thumbs Up. It's cola-ish. It would be their sort of subtitle. But you know, all of a sudden, in the 1990s, Coke and Pepsi came in. And Coke came in with their Global Coke advert. The Global Coke advert, as is now, you had the polar bears in it, right? You know, the polar bears are waddling along, and they lop the top off a bottle of Coke, and they're Coke. They gaze up at the northern lights. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with Indian cultural iconography, but polar bears are not big in India. The northern lights, it doesn't matter so much on an equatorial country. You have a billion people staring at these adverts going, what the bloody hell's that? Whereas Pepsi understood how this worked, and they hired the Bollywood A-list, and so for them, you know, for Pepsi, it was like, Pepsi, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It was just kind of like the end of Slumdog Millionaire, but with Pepsi. And so Pepsi has now sort of has a convincing lead in the Indian soft drink market. But of course, it's a kind of aliens versus predator story here, because whoever wins, Indians lose. And that's the power of corporations, not only to be able to shape the sort of constraints of the food system, but also to be able to shape our tastes, is another way in which they own the food system and they own us. And if you think that you're free of this, I mean, you might think, well, all right, look, I'll go to our local hip grocery, of which there are many in Portland, apparently, and you'll go inside and you'll find something that says, you know, fair trade, shade grown, organic, tuna friendly, dolphin compatible. You know, and there'll be a long list of labels that will, you know, the chicken called Colin. You know, that kind of crazy, absurd, guilt reducing kinds of things that we do. And then, of course, I mean, the trouble is that the minute you step into a supermarket, you're at one of the concentrations of power in the food system. Supermarkets are some of the giants in the food system who own the food supply. But also, you know, when we're consuming, even when we think we're consuming green, we're often in hock to large corporations. There's a fantastic diagram at the Cornucopia Institute, which has the sort of saliva trail of which corporations own which organic food companies. But you know, if you go to buy Earth's Best, for example, that's owned by Hain Celestial, which is owned by Heinz. If you go for Naked Juice, well, that's owned by Pepsi. If you go for Odwalla, well, that's Coca-Cola. And so, you know, there's even when we think we're buying the right things, we find ourselves actually caught in the same similar kinds of trap of being within the confines of the food system. Don't get me wrong. I buy fair trade coffee, for example, because what's the alternative? You know, bastard coffee? I would like the suffering of children in my coffee, please. No, of course. But that's the absurdity here, right? That we actually have the option of buying coffee that involves exploitation of children. That's somehow okay, and that's a legacy of the food system, and it's totally papered over. And even fair trade is, at the end of the day, our way of providing crumbs from the table and shifting those crumbs a little further downstream. But it doesn't alter the sort of fundamental processes of injustice that created, for example, the banana republics in the Caribbean, for instance. Just paying a little bit more for bananas doesn't alter the history of colonialism that's sedimented there. In fact, it kind of extends it a little bit. And so we need to be thinking of other ways of transforming. And so, I would suggest that stepping out of the supermarket is important. And I also think that there are organizations that have interesting ways for us to rethink our relationship to the food system and rethink also the power within that food system that's concentrated in the middle. One of the organizations that I think has a really interesting kind of grab, a really interesting take on this, is Slow Food. Now, many of you may be familiar with slow food and may know it as a sort of circle jerk of olive oil fanciers and red wine fetishists. But in fact, slow food, at its core, slow food is a radical organization because at heart there is a deep, the organizers of slow food, Italians of course, were pushing back against the sort of consumer culture and the fast, you know, the fast food culture. They were pushing back against this myth that, you know, simply by buying the right things at supermarkets, you know, this green consumerist, very American myth, you know, that we can together change the world by shopping. They're pushing back on that and suggesting instead that what you need is not shopping, but we need action. But we also need to understand that food is pleasurable. And I think that this is a tremendously important idea. Food is pleasurable. And what the founders of slow food were very interested in doing was not having a kind of elite bourgeois kind of food culture, but they want to make sure that everyone got the right to pleasure. And what do you need if you're going to have pleasure? You need time and you need money. So what did the organizers of slow food do? Well, first of all, they organized the poorest people in the Italian food system. They organized agricultural workers. So they helped unionize and drive up the wages for agricultural workers so that they weren't treated like dirt, but they had a living wage. So that's fantastic, right? So they're not then trapped into the idea of, well, you know, the only things that they can afford to eat are the cheap, high-calorie foods, you know, the calorie-dense, empty-calorie foods. But instead, now you have the money to be able to eat properly and to be able to cycle that money back into the food system so that workers are well respected in the food system. And then the other thing you need, you need time. So you need money to be able to increase wages. You need time to be able to enjoy the food. And so they organized for a two-hour lunch break so that people could actually enjoy the food and then also do the other things that we do in our lunch breaks. But that organizing, I think, is a really different model from the one that we've come to think of as the way we should approach our food, because for too many of us we still find ourselves trapped by the idea of, well, you know, I don't have enough time, I don't have enough money, and so I'm just going to do what's convenient. And I think this idea of convenience is deeply problematic. So, and I do want to talk a little bit about convenience because it's why we will find ourselves back in the supermarkets, you know, perusing the aisles for those guilt-reducing things, because we don't have enough time, we don't have enough money. And it's important to understand why, because if we're interested in who owns our food system, it's actually important to understand how ownership fits into a bigger picture of social constraints and opportunities. So to understand this, I want to tell you a story from South Africa, where and this is a story that was about that emerged in the beginning of apartheid, where one of the laws that separated white people from black people at the beginning of apartheid was called the Regulation of Separate Amenities Act. And this act meant that white people and black people could no longer share the same spaces for food and couldn't share the same cutlery, the same knives and forks and plates. And this was a problem for black workers on a white golf course in Durban. And so they came up with this very interesting food called bunny chow. Bunny chow is a kind of food that has, basically it's a loaf of white bread with the top cut off and the inside scooped out, and then it's filled with curry. And so it's an interesting food, right? It's syncretic. It's you know, white bread, the food of white people, and curry, the food of black people, and it's mixed. It's kind of a gastronomic way of giving the middle finger to apartheid. But it's also, I mean, think about it. It's a loaf of white bread with curry in it. It's not convenient. There's nothing convenient about a loaf of white bread with curry in it. You can imagine it now just sort of disintegrating on your hand. You have to eat it very fast. You twist and you dip and you eat and you twist and you dip, you eat. But it ends up being an incredibly convenient food. Why? Because of the constraints that we have on our working lives, on the kind of infrastructural constraints that stopped white people and black people from eating together, of the compressed lunch break. And so all of a sudden, the most ridiculous things seem convenient. And if you think that that's just an example that's limited to, you know, apartheid South Africa, think about here. Think about how it is that we have such little time to eat, how it is that we have such little money to be able to eat, why it is that we find the most ridiculous things normal and palatable. I mean, I have no moral high ground here. My PhD was powered by Red Bull. But if you think about Red Bull, and I'm glad that many students are here today. Red Bull, it's aimed at you. I don't know if you've seen the adverts for Red Bull. Red Bull, there's an advert featuring a college student who is faced with the dilemma of completing a term paper or making out with his girlfriend. But if he has Red Bull, he can do both. This Red Bull, I mean, if you look at the ingredients of Red Bull, and if you imagine trying to explain to your great-grandparents what's in Red Bull, you'd be explaining it to them, and you'd be like, well, this is water and caffeine and sugar some basic amino acids, taurine, creatine. The thing is that those, taurine and creatine, these amino acids are most commonly found in your own urine. And so if you were trying to explain to your great-grandparents, have some of this stuff, it's great, it'll keep you awake, it'll give you wings, it'll give you, a few more hours in the day to do all the things you need to do. And you're explaining, well, this looks terrific, what's inside? Well, it's water, sugar, caffeine, and piss. Then questions would be asked, I think. There's nothing normal about this, but it becomes normal because of the structures and the constraints of our working lives. And so in our working lives that have less time for food, that have less money for food, where in the United States we spend much less of our money than anywhere else, our incomes on food. cheap food and cheap gas are the corollaries in the United States of low wages. And when we have those kinds of constraints, and when the food industry itself is copiously subsidized, then all of a sudden we do find the most barbaric, the most insidious things normal. So how do you push back against that? Well, I think slow food has some of the answer about making food joyful. But I think also moving us away from a system of concentrated power is a good idea. And that's harder to imagine. It's harder to imagine wresting power away from the powerful. It's hard to imagine systems where where some of the most profound institutions that shape our society are subverted. And hard to imagine the power of agricultural corporations being tossed out of the window, the companies that tell us that the only way to feed the world is through genetically modified crops, or the only way to feed the world, the only way to fight climate change is through, industrial monoculture. And there are corporations that are selling that myth, and the Monsantos, the Syngentas, the DuPonts, the Dow Chemicals are offering, are saying, look, in terms of climate change and in terms of the future, you need to give us more power. You need to let us control more of your food system to be able to control more of the seed supply, because we are the experts who will be able to transform the way we eat today into the food of tomorrow. We will be able to provide enough food to feed the world. The trouble is that that's a dumb argument for a number of reasons. First of all, we are producing more calories per person than ever before in human history. We have more food per person than we ever have in human history. The reason that people are going hungry today is not from a shortage of food, but because the way we distribute food is through the market, and the people who go hungry are too poor to be able to afford it. Again, think of that bottleneck. So the answer to feeding the world today and tomorrow, it seems to me, doesn't involve giving more power to the agricultural companies and to the banks and to the supermarkets that convey food from one place to another. So how do we do it? Well, I'm in the process of documenting a range of these stories with a fantastic documentary filmmaker, a guy called Steve James. Who did Steve James, the man with two first names? He doesn't get enough name recognition, but he did Hoop Dreams and The Interrupters, two of the finest documentaries in contemporary America. And we're now traveling the world looking at other examples of people who are busting wide open these structures of power. We're looking at stories of people fighting the food corporations in India, in Peru, in the United States, in Detroit. We're looking we're also looking in Oakland. But the story I want to tell you comes from Malawi, because I think it brings together some of the most powerful examples of people busting out of what they have been told is right and proper, and moving to a much more sustainable food system, one that moves us away from this bottleneck and involves a much flatter hierarchy. So here's the story. I mean, Malawi is a very poor country. It's landlocked. It has very little in terms of natural resources. The only thing really it exports is tobacco. And tobacco is not doing well at the moment as an export crop. The Malawian government had a very good idea, which is rather than follow World Bank advice, it was going to support its farmers. So rather than, you know, letting the free market take care of everything, the Malawian government was going to actively engage in supporting its farmers. And so the way it was going to do that, unfortunately, involved by giving farmers fertilizer vouchers for inorganic fertilizer. And in 2008, that's what Malawi did. They spent a lot of money buying fertilizer for the poorest farmers, for all farmers in Malawi. These are some of the poorest farmers in the world. And for some people, this actually was a huge success. And if you look at the difference between 2008 and 2009, harvests doubled. And so that seems good, right? We have fertilizer, and now we have doubling of harvests. The trouble is that mainly between what happened between 2008 and 2009 is that the rains came on time. So although people like Jeffrey Sachs, for example, sort of point to Malawi as an example of why we must subsidize fertilizer, actually the fertilizer made between sort of 10 and 20% of difference. But most of the gain came through the rains coming on time, which they don't do these days. Rains are becoming more and more erratic. And for fertilizer to work properly, you need, you know, rains coming in when they should. And the trouble is, of course, Malawi has no money now because it bought fertilizer at the top of the market. In 2008, when food prices were going up, you'll remember food prices going sky high in 2008. But the commodity whose price went the highest was fertilizer, which went up 250%. So Malawi bankrupted itself in order to be able to get get the fertilizer into the hands of farmers. And now the fertilizer returns are lower and lower. And in northern Malawi right now, despite these fertilizer interventions, there's been hunger, widespread hunger. But the story I want to tell you is southern Malawi is where the hunger is. Northern Malawi is where this story of sustainability is. And this happens in a village called Bwabwa, where the farmers initially started getting involved to try and eradicate child malnutrition. And they discovered, well, in order to eradicate child malnutrition in a country where life expectancy is 53 years old, where the rate of people living with HIV/AIDS is around 15 to 18%, things are pretty bad. But you, in order to have healthy, nutritious food, you need to eradicate. Well, you need to move away from things like corn. Corn is not a terribly healthy crop. And so instead they moved towards growing more nutritious crops, and then they found that actually you could grow these crops together and you could use them you could have farming systems that were diversified, that were robust in terms of climate change. And so now they have these incredible farming systems that involve cowpea and millet and sorghum and soybeans and a range of things, and leguminous trees that are nitrogen fixing, so they help improve soil quality. And these trees reach over and they provide shade to the crops. And we often think that shade is a bad thing for crops, but because of climate change, it gets so hot in the fields that photosynthesis stops. It stops around 104 degrees Fahrenheit. And so after that, photosynthesis doesn't work. So you need shade to be able to increase yield. And they find that with a 15% increase in shade cover, yields go up by 15%. And now you have this amazing diversified farm system. And you have an amazing range of really nutritious crops. But there's a problem. And I wonder if you can help solve it. The problem is this, that there is more food in the fields than with traditional agriculture. This diversified farming system produces 15% more food than industrial agriculture, the agriculture of the bottleneck. Well, this diversified farming system has much better kinds of outcomes because the farmers are all scientists and they're all experimenting, and so they've multiplied the kinds of experiments they've done, and they've got this amazing farming system. There's more food in the fields. How is it possible to have more foods in the fields and for infant malnutrition to go up? Anyone? Take a guess. They don't like the food. Partly that's an issue, but actually many of these crops are familiar. Yeah. lack of breastfeeding. That's it. The reason that it's possible for more food to be there in the fields and for infant malnutrition to go up is because harvesting is women's work. Harvesting is women's work, but also so is cooking and cleaning and fetching firewood and breastfeeding. So when there's more food in the fields, it's possible for all these other things to remain the same and for breastfeeding to go down. So how do you fix that? Put the men to work. Very good idea. And in fact, that's what the farmers in Malawi said. It was like, okay, right, we need to get the men to cook. How do you do that? There is giggling in the audience. So initially what they do is a kind of food network approach, but like a personal food network approach, which is where they go, the farmers themselves, this is driven by Malawian farmers, women and men who want to fight infant malnutrition. And so they're like, okay, we're going to teach men to cook. And we're going to do that with by going around to everyone's house. We'll go with a cook and a nutritionist, and we will teach men. We're like, men, here's a pot. You may have seen one of these before. Here's how you use it over a fire, and here's how you stir it, and here's how you make some terrific nutritious things. What do you think of that? The men are like, well, that's very good. Well done. Thanks very much. And then the nutritionist and the cook would go, and men would be like, oh, sod that. And things would remain basically the same. So then what happened was a brilliant idea from the farmers there, which was a recipe day. And a recipe day is a fantastic thing because, they were working with kale. Sorry, we're working with kale. Well, they were working with sorghum and millet and cowpea and soybeans. And, these were incredibly nutritious crops, but often people didn't know what to do with these things. In that way, it was very much like kale, right? I mean, you've got this fantastic nutritious thing. You have not the first idea how to eat it. In Portland, everyone knows how to eat it. But in other parts of the world. So you have these sort of crops where some of them were unfamiliar. Soy, for example, is not native to Sub-Saharan Africa. And so people were trying to figure out how to do this. But what was interesting about this recipe day was that it was an equal space, a space of equality and of absent hierarchy. And so everyone was learning, but everyone was kind of teaching each other. And so you have women and men pounding away at the soy to make soy milk, for example. And you have recipes where women and men would